to see them. And because he was of the same trade, he stayed with them and worked, for they were tent makers by trade. And he reasoned in the synagogue every Sabbath and tried to persuade Jews and Greeks. And when Silas and Timothy arrived from Macedonia, Paul was occupied with the word, testifying to the Jews that the Christ was Jesus. And when they opposed and reviled him, he shook out his garments and he said to them, "Your blood be on your own heads. I am innocent. From now on, I will go to the Gentiles." And he left there and went to the house of a man named Titius Justus, a worshiper of our God. His house was next door to the synagogue. Crispus, the ruler of the synagogue, believed in the Lord together with his entire household. And many of the Corinthians, hearing Paul, believed and were baptized. And the Lord said to Paul one night in a vision, "Do not be afraid, but go on speaking and do not be silent, for I am with you. And no one will attack you to harm you, for I have many in the city who are my people." And he stayed a year and 6 months, teaching the word of God among them. This is the word of the Lord. You may be seated. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm on, yeah?
Okay.
I bring you greetings from your brothers and sisters at Community Covenant Church, where I am usually on Sunday mornings. It's good to be with you all. The name of and title of this sermon this morning is "It's Good Work, If You Can Get It: Reflections on Ministry and Vocation." See, work has been a major subject in my household lately for a handful of reasons. Ever since my wife and I have been married, she has always been the primary breadwinner in our family. And we've got two young children, and we've kind of come to this point where we're realizing that we'd really like to switch roles so that she can be home with our kids while they are preschoolers, and I can bring in the moolah. And we, to that end, have thrown our names into our denomination's pastoral job pool and begun the search process. But that process has forced me to wrestle with some really deep questions about the nature of work in general, of ministry in particular, and has brought to light different aspects of my own spiritual journey. In particular, when I look at what it takes to be a pastor, I grew up as a pastor's kid. So I have a frame of reference of what the really good things about being in pastoral ministry can be. I've also had a front row seat as to how nasty it can get sometimes. I have served as a pastor. Before my wife and I moved out here, I was pastoring a small church in the Chicago area, and I did that for about 2.5 years. And I've served on staffs at various churches, most recently at Community Covenant, where I've been working as the pastor of college ministry. And I feel, being 37 years old now, that I'm kind of standing on the brink of something, because I have been on pastoral staff now for these past 2.5 years at Community Covenant, but I haven't been the pastor, and there's a big difference. And I feel like I'm kind of, my toes are kind of standing, teetering over the edge of a vast precipice, kind of going, do I really want to take this leap? What am I in for if I jump for it into the hands of God and into what? Pastoral ministry? Or do I do something else and, you know, still minister but in a different career? How is this all going to work out? And how on earth did I get here in the first place? Well, what follows this morning are some personal observations that I've drawn from our text this morning as I've been working through Acts. So go ahead, cue the next slide. All right, so to set the stage, let's get some context. How many of you have been slogging through the book of Acts here in this? Okay, you've been making it. I've been to a couple of churches that have said, "Let's preach our way through Acts." And 2 to 5 years later, they finish. So kudos to you. You're brave souls. All right, here we go. Acts 18. Now, okay, wait, back up. Okay, good. Okay, just one click now. So in this part of Acts, the Apostle Paul was busy on one of his missionary journeys. He was about to go, tool around Asia Minor for a little bit. But then in a dream, he saw a vision of this Macedonian guy, okay, so like northern Greece, Macedonia, saying, come to Macedonia and help us. So Paul and his friends say, oh, God must want us to go there. So they pack their bags. No real travel plans. They just jump on a boat and make for Macedonia, figuring God will take care of everything on the way, right? So where do they land? Go for it. Philippi. They meet a lady named Lydia, right? And she's a dealer in purple cloth, get a little house church started. In the process, though, they also get severely flogged, imprisoned, and that's the story where they do escape. God miraculously springs the doors open. You know, they stand up, they get out, and the jailer is converted. But still, it's a rough experience. The next town they go to, Thessalonica. They're preaching. Again, they get a little house church started. But the other local Jews in the area are not particularly thrilled about this gospel that they're spreading, and they're splitting up synagogues. So a citywide riot gets sparked, and they have to flee for their lives. So then they run to the next town, where they talk, and they get a little bit of a house church going again, but some people from Thessalonica follow them and stir up that crowd again. And so they again have to flee for their lives, but this time the team splits up. Paul winds up going to Athens, but he tells his two young assistants, Silas and Timothy, hey, you guys stay here. These churches need your help. You keep working with them, but I'm going to move on. So Paul winds up alone in Athens. Go ahead. Once he gets to Athens, the text says that he looks around and he is really disturbed by the number of idols that he sees up. Now, this is kind of intriguing to me because I would think that Athens would probably be pretty par for the course in terms of the number of pagan temples and idols. But for whatever reason, he's really moved. And he gives a speech, and then he gets involved in conversation with a bunch of Stoic and Epicurean philosophers who are saying, well, what is this you're talking about? Some people he wins over and converts. But the rest of the Areopagus, the philosophers of the day, just kind of blow him off. Say, I don't know what, you're crazy. You're talking about people coming back from the dead. So finally, Paul gets on a boat and then goes to Corinth. He gets there, he's alone, and he's broke. Now, if you were Paul, what would your perspective on ministry be at this point? You thought God had invited you to come to Macedonia on this wild and epic adventure, and it has certainly been an adventure. You can't deny that. But maybe not exactly what you had hoped for. What follows are a few observations, then, about his life and time in Corinth, things that I have found helpful. So,
go ahead, next slide.
Corinth itself, as you can see, this is roughly the route that he took. So he came up, he went to Philippi, and then Thessalonica, and then over to Berea, and then down to Athens, and then finally to Corinth. Corinth is a city, many scholars believe, was probably second only to Rome in terms of its wealth and the degree of its influence and power. You can see where it's situated. It's right at this isthmus of Corinth. And it had two ports, one on the east and one on the west. And it was kind of the Panama Canal of its day. Captains would send their boats this way, and then there was a 3.5-mile, like, I don't know what you'd call it, kind of railroad of logs that you could roll boats across to get to the other side, put them in the water, and then keep sailing to the Middle East. Because of that, Corinth was extremely wealthy. Very, very, very wealthy. And it was also, as wealth tends to corrupt, extremely debauched. One of the patron deities of Corinth was Aphrodite, and they had a temple with over 1,000 temple prostitutes that were doing a roaring business at the time. But because of its cosmopolitan nature, they had immigrants and people who were working in the city from all over the known world, including a fairly sizable Jewish population. And that is where Paul finally lands. So,
go ahead, next slide. So the first thing that we're going to talk about
are some observations about work itself.
Go ahead, hit the button. All right,
so let's read this again. Acts 18, 1 through 4. After this, Paul left Athens and he went to Corinth. And there he met a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus who had recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius, the emperor, had ordered all the Jews to leave Rome. And Paul went with them, and because he was a tent maker as they were, he stayed and worked with them. Every Sabbath, though, he reasoned in the synagogue, trying to persuade Jews and Greeks. Well, this is new. We discover that Paul actually knows how to do a job, other than be a scribe and a Pharisee and an apostle. Tent making in this case likely is a reference to leather working. I don't know. This was news to me, but most tents in those days were actually made of leather. Any of you backpackers? Usually you want a tent to be lightweight. Can you imagine how heavy a tent made of leather would be? But it was kind of nice because if you're a leather worker, you can bring your tools with you. If you're a weaver, you need a loom and you need all this other equipment, but likely Paul had this little toolkit that he was able to go and set up shop wherever he went. So the pros of working in this case for Paul, well, obviously it paid the bills. It gave him an inn with the local Jewish community and its tradesmen, and it provided a natural venue for informal dialogue. You see, when you sat down and you were working on somebody's sandal or something, people would probably just sit in your shop watching you work until you were done. Well, you can pass the time and strike up some conversation. Have you heard about this Jesus guy? Cons. Well, it's not very glorious work for a student of Gamaliel, who Paul says he was a student of, right? He was supposed to be this up-and-coming religious superstar. And here he is fixing sandals in Corinth. Another con, many Greek philosophers looked down on any kind of manual labor, skilled or otherwise. That was for really lousy people. You know, if you really had your act together, you didn't soil your hands with that kind of stuff. And finally, one of the cons is that as long as Paul had to support himself, he was unable to devote himself full-time to preaching the gospel. However, it did open up time for him to talk with his co-workers, his new co-workers, who were Aquila and Priscilla. Now, scholars the majority of scholars, by the way, are always arguing about everything, right? So, but the majority at this point believe that Priscilla and Aquila were probably already Christians before they met Paul. And that's one of the reasons they had fled from Italy. You see, the Roman historian Suetonius actually records the expulsion that Luke talks about in Acts. What was happening was the Jewish population in Rome was getting flipped inside out by people preaching about Jesus, and it started to spark riots. And so the Emperor Claudius' response was, listen, if you two can't settle down, I'm just going to kick you all out. And so he did. And so Aquila and Priscilla left and landed at Corinth. And there they were, and there Paul was, and they were able to strike up both some good business and some good conversation. We are able to infer that Aquila and Priscilla probably were people of means because they had the money to actually lift their business up out of Rome and keep going in Corinth. We also know that they were probably sufficiently connected to the people in Rome because later in the book of Romans, when Paul says, please greet the following people, he says, please greet Aquila and Priscilla. So eventually they moved back. They went back. So what can we infer from this? Well, one thing it's worth noting, that Paul is a professional missionary who is now working as a tradesperson. And Aquila and Priscilla are professional tradespersons who are now working as missionaries. And they're overlapping. They're working side by side, which I think is really encouraging. Because in different seasons of life, God gives you different jobs to do. At some points, you may find yourself being a professional missionary, called to vocational ministry. But other times you might not. But God uses you just the same. Another thing to point out, in today's economy, it's increasingly difficult to find economic stability, much less an identity. How many of you are working part-time jobs right now? Just curious. Okay. Yeah. full-time jobs are becoming harder and harder to find. And yet it seems that our broader culture continues to churn out movies and books that urge us to chase our dreams and pursue that one thing that'll kind of give focus and meaning to everything we do. Of course, they never bother to actually give parameters for what that one thing might be, much less define it. But as Christians, of course, we do indeed have one calling, and that is to follow Jesus Christ wherever he leads, be it into vocational ministry or some other career path. And for me, as I've been kind of mulling this over in my own process, thinking about what God may have in store for me and my family next, I was reminded of a moment not too long after, actually right before I graduated from college. And I was agonizing over, oh my gosh, I'm about to graduate. What am I going to do with my life? What kind of job should I pursue? At the time, I'd gotten a theater major and I really loved the arts. But I also had all these burning questions about church and theology and God. And I just, in a moment of prayer, I said, all right, God, what do I do? What am I supposed to do? And immediately this image came to mind of me kind of standing in a room, almost like a game show, with a whole bunch of different doors, right? Are you going to choose door number one, or what's behind door number two, or what's behind door? Choose, and that's your fate, you know? And I'm like, ah! But then I sensed God, in my mind's eye, Jesus was kind of standing behind me with a hand on my shoulder, kind of going, well, pick one. And I kind of turned to him and said, well, that's exactly the problem. Like, this is a nasty game show. Like, if I pick one door, it might have, you know, really good things. But if I pick the wrong door, I might end up with, I don't know, like a dirty sock or something. Like, I don't know. I want to pick the right door. Can you just use your omnipotence to tell me which way I am supposed to go? And the word that came back was, Jaron, it matters less in this instance. It matters less what door you pick as who you walk through that door with. It matters less what door you pick than who you walk through that door with. Jesus was essentially saying, just pick one, take my hand, and let's go. As long as you stand here and you don't move, we're not going anywhere. It's much easier to redirect an animal or a vehicle or a cart if it's moving. When you stop and you just agonize over it, you can't go anywhere. Start moving. If Jesus doesn't want you to go somewhere, he will stop you. He will redirect you. He will shut doors in your face so fast it's not even funny. But 9 times out of 10, unless something you're considering is blatantly sinful, my sense is Jesus is saying, pick. Make a choice. Let's go for it. I'm going with you wherever you're going. So let's go. Let's find out what's behind it. If you're like me, you say, I just want the one that involves the least pain. The bad news is Jesus says, well, no matter which door you choose, there's going to be pain involved. That's life. But I'll be with you. So for those of you who may be agonizing over what major to choose or what career to pursue, relax a bit. If the options before you are not blatantly sinful, like I just said, Jesus is probably waiting for you to pick. So take his hand and walk through a door. Paul had learned how to be a tent maker. He had worked as a Pharisee. He persecuted the church. Eventually, he became an apostle. Aquila and Priscilla ran a profitable business as a husband and wife team and pastored house churches in multiple cities throughout the Roman Empire. If God can manage those kinds of career transitions, are you seriously telling me you don't think God can handle your life? You think God's going to let you waste your life? I don't think so. So, second thing, go ahead. Continue on. A word about evangelism and pastoral ministry. Here we go. Acts 18:5-6. When Silas and Timothy came from Macedonia, Paul devoted himself exclusively to preaching, testifying to the Jews that Jesus was the Messiah. I'm going to pause right there. So Paul had been broke and alone until he got to Corinth. God provides him co-workers, a job, and Christian community. That's pretty sweet. Now his assistants come. Silas and Timothy. We know from the other letters, 1 and 2 Corinthians, that when they came, they likely brought some actual cash from the Macedonian churches who were supporting Paul. So now he's got some money, he's got some helpers. It's also interesting to note, and I had not paid attention to this, that the very presence of Silas and Timothy was likely a cross-cultural witness to the gospel. Silas is a Jewish boy. Tim is a Gentile boy. They come together, and they're working to help this old Jewish guy out as they preach. Now, you tell me what kind of message that sends to this young church. They're seeing them work together. So, help comes, but, verse 6, when they opposed Paul, the Jews in the synagogue, when they opposed Paul and became abusive, he shook out his clothes in protest and said to them, "Your blood be on your own heads. I am innocent of it. From now on, I'm going to go to the Gentiles." Now, what is that about? Your blood be on your own heads? Is that the kind of language you use every day? I hope not. What Paul is doing is he's referencing the language of the prophet Ezekiel. Go ahead. Hit the button. This is what it says. God speaks to Ezekiel, and he says, right before this verse, something along the lines of, "Ezekiel, if you're part of a community that is under threat of war, and you know an enemy army is coming, and your community posts you as a watchman, and the army comes, and you don't say anything, are you not guilty for their blood? On the other hand, if the army comes and you do raise the alarm and people don't listen to you, that's their problem if they die. But you have your job to do." And then this is what God says. "Son of man, I have made you a watchman for the people Israel. So hear the word I speak and give them warning from me. When I say to the wicked, 'You wicked person, you will surely die,' and you do not speak out to dissuade them from their ways, that wicked person will die for their sin, and I will hold you accountable for their blood. But if you do warn the wicked person to turn from their ways, and they don't do so, they will die for their sin, though you yourself will be saved." I don't know about you, but I find that really sobering. I would like to be able to say, "That was God talking to Ezekiel, not me." But judging from the Apostle Paul's behavior, I don't think that's the case. If you have saving knowledge, if you have anything worth sharing with somebody you need, and you don't say anything, you don't raise the alarm, you don't do something, you're accountable for that. You're accountable for that. And I've been asking myself, boy, have I been a faithful watchman for my people? Who are my people? And do I care enough about anybody to risk conflict, to raise the alarm, to say, "You know what? We're not doing right here." Now, I want to point out something, too. Paul said this in reference specifically to his fellow Jews. He wasn't shaking the folds of his robe out at pagan Corinth, right? I mean, obviously they're not going to get it. He was speaking specifically to the people who were supposed to understand the gospel, the people who were supposed to have gone, "Oh, the Messiah, we understand this." Similarly, as Christians, we have a call to speak truth to one another. Jesus tells the parable about, you know, don't go and try to take the speck out of your brother or sister's eye when you've got a log sticking out of your own. And most Christians kind of chuckle and go, "Oh, yeah, that's a good point. You know, you can't be a hypocrite, you know." But usually what happens is the person says, "Oh, you're right, I shouldn't try to take the speck out of that person's eye." But they don't bother taking this one out either. So what you have is a bunch of blind people wandering around bumping into each other. Somebody has to start taking stuff out of people's eyes. And we need each other to do that. Have you ever tried to get something out of your own eye? It's painful. It's no fun. Sometimes you need somebody else to help you. In particular, for me personally, Helicon mentioned the current political situation. This, to me, is one of those things where I know I feel a definite burden for the church here in America. I think this recent election cycle just really opened my eyes. I'm not so naive to think that everything was honky-dory before this. But hearing Christians that I love on both sides of the political spectrum saying things and supporting things that just blew my mind, and getting so frustrated with the two major parties that supposedly represent our nation, it's time for the church to figure out who it is. It's time for the church to take a stand and start offering a more godly alternative to what we see. I think I feel that especially because I am a white, male, evangelical from the Midwest. I grew up in Minnesota. So even though I disagree with many, 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 many of our current president's positions, I know and have met many brothers and sisters who probably voted for him without a qualm, and I want to hear them. But somehow, as Christians, we've got to move forward in some different and holier ways on both sides of the aisle. So I guess my question on this point of evangelism is, as you read a passage like this, do you feel a burden like this for anybody? For anybody? Or is your world so self-focused and self-contained that your heart has no space to react out of love for those who desperately need to hear the truth that God has? Another question would be, what makes you most uncomfortable about this kind of responsibility? I know I'm really uncomfortable. In fact, frankly, I feel like it feels like a terrible weight, a burden, unless we advance the next slide. Unless we can get a good, healthy dose of reality. And by that I mean, have something shake us up enough to remember that God is, in fact, still God. All right, let's read this. Then Paul left the synagogue. So after he shook out the folds from his robe, Paul left the synagogue, went next door to the house of Titius Justus, a worshiper of God. And Crispus, the synagogue leader, and his entire household believed in the Lord. And many of the Corinthians who heard Paul believed and were baptized. How many of you have been a part of a church during a church split? Anybody? Been a part of a church during a church split? Is it any fun? No. Okay. In these few lines, this is exactly what Luke is saying. Paul has been preaching in the Jewish synagogue. Half of the, you know, there's a vocal majority who's saying, this is a bunch of baloney. Paul says, all right, I'm leaving you, I'm going to the Greeks. But he moves right next door to the house, Titius Justus, a worship of God. So you're setting up shop right next to the other church, and you took the synagogue ruler with him. Can you imagine the relational atmosphere in that neighborhood? Add to that the level of complexity with the emperor of Rome having just expelled the Jews from the city because of all this inner turmoil that they were causing. The last thing you want to do is to split. You want to try and keep everybody together. But that's exactly what's going on. And if I was Paul, I think I would be starting to wonder, oh boy, is this going to be Philippi or Thessalonica all over again? Are we heading for a riot? Is that where this is going to go again? But that's where we come to the next verse. Go ahead. But then one night the Lord spoke to Paul in a vision. And it seems to me God always speaks exactly what we need, exactly when we need it, and not a moment before. And I think this is exactly what Paul needed to hear at this moment. The first thing God says, do not be afraid. Don't be afraid. And do not be silent. For I am with you. And no one is going to attack and harm you. Because I have many people in this city. Well, first of all, it's very encouraging. I know if I were in Paul's shoes, I'd probably wake up and go, wow. And then, wait, you have people? This is Corinth. Where are they? But they come out of the woodwork. They do. See, God gives us what we need when we need it. Paul was tired. He was tired of having to constantly run for his life, preaching in one city, getting a church started, then having to run away, going to another city, getting a church started, having to run away. It is no small thing that the very last verse in this little chunk says, so Paul stayed in Corinth for a year and a half, teaching the word of God. After all of Paul's little hit-and-miss things, finally, God gives him the assurance, listen, you can settle down here for a little bit. Just keep working, but take a break at the same time. You can set down a few roots here. Roots to such an extent that, folks, there is still an active church in Corinth today. So what happened? What happened in that moment? Well, I would suggest that Paul, in that word that God gave him, Paul got a dose of reality, a reminder that God is, in fact, good, that despite all the things that Paul is suffering, that God loves him, that God's got his back, and ultimately God is still in control. God is still God. Paul was acutely aware of all these things. Are you? It's so easy to lose sight of these basic truths in the chaos of everyday life. I mean, hey, even Paul, the great apostle, he needed a good word from the Lord. And Paul knew that the Corinthian church needed such a reminder as well. That's why Paul's words from 1 Corinthians, a letter he wrote later to this very church, hit me like a ton of bricks. And by the way, one of the fun things about the book of Acts is to read it in tandem with Paul's letters that he's writing to the churches mentioned. Suddenly, everything pops out in 3D. So if you're reading about Corinth, go and read 1 and 2 Corinthians. This is what struck me. Paul says this, and so it was with me, brothers and sisters. When I came to you, I did not come with eloquence or human wisdom as I proclaimed to you the testimony about God. For I resolved to know nothing while I was with you, except Jesus Christ and him crucified. I came to you in weakness, with great fear and trembling. Think about Paul washing ashore in Corinth. He knows what's happened in every other city that he's come to. It's been riots and mayhem. So he says, I came to you with great fear and trembling. But my message and my preaching were not with wise and persuasive words, but with a demonstration of the Spirit's power, so that your faith may not rest on human wisdom, but on God's power. Now, why do I bring this up? Well, like I said, when I read this, it hit me like a ton of bricks, and it helped explain to me how, even though I've seen many other pastors burn out, how Paul managed to keep going. In ministry, there is a temptation to feel the pressure of all the things that a church can ask of a person and to feel like, oh my goodness, I have to have all these plans, and I need to have these structures, and I need to have these programs, and to some degree you do. It's part of the job. But Paul is saying, Corinthians, don't you remember, when I came to you, I didn't come with some slick program. I didn't have a neat agenda. I didn't even come with really well thought out words. What I came to you with was the absolute undeniable reality of God, and the Spirit of God demonstrated its power among you. As I've been in this call process, I was asked not too long ago, so what would your ideal ministry look like? Which seems like on one hand, really weird question. My brain just doesn't work. I know what they were asking, you know. Would you be like to serve in a church that's big or small, with young families or youth, or like, what's your ideal ministry? But this is the verse that immediately popped to mind. You know, frankly, I don't care where God puts me, but give me a ministry that is not anchored on how slick the programming is, how smooth-tongued the pastor is. I want a ministry that is a clear demonstration of the Spirit's power, where the power of God just continues to shine through undeniably. That's what I want for my whole life. So on the question of work, I don't care what job I have. Just let it be a channel, an opening, a vehicle for the demonstration of the Spirit's power to come crashing in and changing things wherever I land. Same thing with evangelism. That's the thing that makes the whole watchman thing even bearable, is it's not your job. It's God's. God's the one who's far more invested in it than you are. You be faithful, open up a channel for God to come crashing through. He's going to start changing the lives of the people around you if you let him start changing yours. Let your life be a demonstration of the Spirit's power. In a weird sort of way, I think this is what the Lord's Prayer points to. One of our pastors preached through it not too long ago, and something struck me. So here, maybe you can say the first few parts of it with me. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Stop. Okay, so you've got this. Okay, God in heaven, our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Let your name be magnified. We want you to look good. We want your power to come. Everything else is a subpoint underneath that overarching line, right? How do we want your name to be hallowed? Well, let your kingdom come. That would do it. Let your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Lord, it would give glory to you. Unleash your power. Show people by giving us what we need, our daily bread. Show people your power by forgiving us our sins, just as you forgive us. Show people your power by delivering us from temptation and from evil, because yours is the kingdom and the glory and the power forever. Amen. So if you're like me, I don't want to play Sunday school. I want the real thing. Amen? You want to lay hold of the reality of God. Whatever it was that kept Paul going through all this mad stuff. It's interesting, too, to note that were we to continue the next few verses, what's the very next thing that happens? There's a riot, and Paul gets swept up. But he doesn't get beaten. He gets off. And the Jews who have all worked together to get him, they get turned away by the Roman official, and they're so angry, and they really want to beat somebody up, so they beat up their own synagogue ruler. But Paul gets off the hook. I want the real thing. I want the God who is powerful, who acts. If this whole gospel business is really true, let me at it. Otherwise, don't waste my time. Don't waste my time. As Paul discovered, staying plugged into the reality of God and God's power and love give courage to take on new work in whatever form, provides strength and relief from the awesome responsibility of evangelism, because God does the heavy lifting. And he gives us the desire to carry on, staying anchored in the reality that God is indeed still God, that he is still good, and that he still loves us, transforms our lives into the adventures that they were meant to be. And that is indeed good work, if we can get it. Last time I checked, Jesus is still accepting applications. So are you in? Are you up for it? Pray with me.